Welcome to our deep dive today. We're taking a look at Plato's Phaedo. We'll be exploring Socrates' final hours and his arguments for the immortality of the soul.
Yeah, the Phaedo is really interesting. It doesn't feel like a somber goodbye, more like a celebration of intellectual curiosity, with Socrates engaging in deep philosophical discussions right up until the end.
So we have the setting. Socrates is in prison, awaiting execution, surrounded by his friends. Having just said goodbye to his wife and children, what happens next? What are some of the big ideas we'll be looking at?
Well, we'll be going over several of Socrates' arguments for the soul's immortality, starting with this concept of a cycle of life and death. Then we'll explore the theory of recollection. This suggests that learning is actually a process of remembering things our souls knew from a previous existence.
And we'll also be examining Socrates' argument that the soul, because it's capable of pure thought, is more like the divine and eternal, unlike the ever-changing physical body. Okay, so let's start with the scene itself. Socrates is in prison, but he's not exactly wallowing in despair, is he?
Not at all. Plato actually describes him as being quite cheerful, joking about the pleasure that follows the pain of having his chains removed. He even compares it to a two-headed creature from Aesop's fables.
That's an interesting comparison. I'm also noticing a lot of references to music and poetry, too. Wasn't Socrates putting Aesop's fables into verse?
Yes, inspired by dreams telling him to practice music, which leads to a fascinating exchange with Avenus. He's a poet who happens to be there. Socrates encourages Avenus to follow him in death, not through suicide, which he believes is unlawful, but by dedicating himself to philosophy.
That's certainly a unique way to frame the pursuit of philosophy, as a kind of preparation for death. Does this connect to his argument about the cycle of life and death?
Absolutely. Socrates seems to view death as a natural transition, not something to be feared, especially for those who have dedicated their lives to wisdom. This first argument for the soul's immortality rests on an ancient doctrine that the living come from the dead. And if that's the case, then logically, souls must exist in another realm to be reborn.
So it's a continuous existence, with souls moving between this world and another.
Right.
But he doesn't just stop there. Right. He also brings up this idea of recollection.
Exactly. Socrates acknowledges that this first argument relies on accepting the premise that the living are born from the dead. So he introduces the theory of recollection as further evidence for the soul's pre-existence.
How does that work? Is he saying that we're not actually learning new things, but just remembering what our souls already knew?
That's the basic idea. Socrates suggests that what we perceive as learning is actually a process of our souls recollecting knowledge they acquired in a previous existence. He uses some relatable examples, like how seeing a lyre might remind someone of the person who played it.
Or how a picture of one friend can instantly bring to mind another friend. He's suggesting that tangible things can trigger memories of something more.
Yes, and he takes it a step further. Socrates argues that encountering imperfect material things in this world can actually trigger the recollection of perfect absolute concepts like equality.
You can't physically touch or see equality, but you understand the concept.
Wow.
So our souls must have encountered these absolute concepts like perfect equality, beauty, justice, before we were born in a realm where these things exist in their pure form.
That's the core of his argument. It suggests that the soul's existence predates our physical birth and that it possesses a capacity for knowledge that transcends our bodily experiences. But Socrates doesn't stop there. He goes on to argue that the very nature of the soul suggests its immortality.
Okay, I'm curious to hear more about that. How does he connect the soul's nature to its potential for immortality?
Socrates makes a clear distinction between the soul and the body. He says that the soul, in its pure thought, is unchanging, eternal, similar to the divine. The body, on the other hand, is always in flux, subject to decay and death.
So he's saying that because the soul is not material, it's not bound by the same limitations as the physical body.
Ah.
A fascinating argument, but I'm sure not everyone just accepted it, right?
Yeah.
You're right. Even in Socrates' time, there were different viewpoints. In the Phaedo, we meet two people, Simmias and Cibas, who raise some significant objections to Socrates' arguments.
I'm ready to hear those counterarguments.
Yeah.
Who are Simmias and Cibas, and what kind of challenges do they bring up?
Well, Simmias and Cibas are followers of another philosopher, Philolaus, who is a Pythagorean. Simmias uses an analogy, comparing the soul to the harmony of a lyre. He suggests that just as the harmony disappears when the lyre is broken, the soul might cease to exist when the body dies.
That's a pretty compelling image. It makes you wonder if the soul is really separate from the body. or if it's more like a byproduct of her physical existence. What about Sebes? What kind of challenge does he present?
Sebes takes a slightly different approach. He says that the soul might be very long-lived, maybe even outlasting multiple bodies, but he questions whether it's truly immortal. He compares it to a weaver who might outlive many coats but eventually dies.
Okay, so Simmias questions the soul's independence, and Sebes questions its permanence. These are some tough objections. How does Socrates respond?
Socrates doesn't shy away from these challenges. He calmly and methodically addresses each one, demonstrating his commitment to philosophical inquiry, even facing his own death.
This dedication to truth-seeking, even in his final hours, is remarkable. It makes his arguments even more compelling, don't you think?
I agree. It adds a layer of authenticity to his words. It's one thing to argue about the soul's immortality in the abstract, but it's quite another to see Socrates embody this belief as he faces death.
So how does he tackle these counterarguments? Does he manage to refute them entirely?
He offers rebuttals to both. In response to Simmias' harmony analogy, Socrates points out that the soul actually governs and directs the body. This goes against the idea of the soul being a mere byproduct, dependent on the body's elements.
So the soul is more like the musician playing the lyre than the harmony itself.
Exactly. He's saying that the soul is the active force, shaping and controlling the body, and not a passive result of its physical structure. And to address Sebes' concern about the soul's potential for perishing, Socrates explains the difference between two types of opposites, concrete opposites and essential opposites.
Okay, I need a little help with this one. What does he mean by concrete and essential opposites?
Think of concrete opposites like hot and cold. An object can be hot at one point and then become cold later, but essential opposites like life and death are different. Socrates argues that the soul, by its very nature, cannot admit death.
It's like saying the number three can't be even. It just goes against its fundamental nature.
Exactly. Socrates argues that the soul is essentially linked to life, and therefore death is simply not a possibility for it. It's a bold claim, and it raises further questions about the soul's ultimate fate. But before we dive into that, Socrates shares a bit about his own intellectual journey, which helps to understand his perspective.
This personal touch is what I love about the Phaedon. It's not just abstract philosophizing. We're getting a glimpse into Socrates' own search for truth. Tell me more about this part of the dialogue.
Socrates talks about a time when he was really interested in the ideas of Anaxagoras, another philosopher who proposed that mind was the cause of all things. Socrates was hoping that Anaxagoras could explain the world in terms of what was best, the most rational, the most purposeful.
It sounds like he was seeking some ultimate explanation for why things are the way they are, but it seems like he was a bit let down by Anaxagoras' approach, right?
He was. Socrates found that Anaxagoras wasn't consistent in his use of mind as an explanation. Instead, he often fell back on explanations like winds and waters, which Socrates felt were too simplistic. They didn't address the true cause of things.
It's like saying that the reason Socrates is in prison is because of his bones and muscles, rather than acknowledging the Athenians' decision to sentence him.
Exactly. Socrates felt that Anaxagoras was mistaking the conditions for the true cause. And this disillusionment led Socrates to shift his focus to what he called the second best.
What did he mean by the second best? Was he settling for a less rigorous form of inquiry?
Not at all. Instead of searching for ultimate causes, Socrates decided to focus on examining the consequences of ideas to determine their truth. It's like building a raft to navigate life's complexities.
It's a more practical approach to philosophical inquiry. He's saying, let's look at the effects of an idea and see if it holds up. Rather than getting bogged down and searching for some ultimate unknowable cause, it seems like this shift in thinking might have led him to the more mythical aspects of the Phaedo.
Right. You're on the right track. This is where we transition to Socrates' description of the afterlife, which is presented as a myth.
Before we dive into that, it's important to note that Socrates isn't necessarily presenting this myth as literal truth.
That's a crucial point. He's offering it as a way to think about the soul's fate after death, a way to explore the possibilities. It's like a thought experiment.
Okay, I'm ready to hear about this mythical afterlife. What kind of picture does Socrates paint?
He describes the earth as a multicolored sphere with various hollows and regions. Some of these regions are more beautiful and pure than the one we inhabit. He also speaks of the rivers of the underworld: Oceanus, Acheron, Paraphlegethon, Cocytus.
The imagery is so vivid. These names, they're almost musical. Is there a particular reason he chooses these specific rivers?
Each river represents a different aspect of the underworld. Acheron is the river of woe, Paraphlegethon, the river of fire, and Cocytus, the river of wailing. They each symbolize the challenges and purifications the soul might encounter in its journey after death.
It sounds like he's creating a sort of map of the soul's potential journey, complete with its own geography and landmarks. But what happens to souls once they enter this realm? How does he envision their fate?
This is where the idea of judgment comes in. Socrates describes how souls are assessed based on their conduct in life and sent to different regions accordingly.
So what are the criteria for judgment? Is it based on specific actions, or more on the overall character of the soul?
That's a good question. Socrates says that virtuous souls ascend to a higher realm, a place of extraordinary beauty and peace.
So a reward for a life well-lived,
dedicated
to pursuing wisdom and virtue.
Yeah, you could say that, but for souls burdened by vice, you know, those weighed down by earthly desires and attachments, the journey is different. They remain trapped in the cycle of reincarnation, reborn into new lives to work through their imperfections.
Reincarnation. It adds another layer to the idea of immortality. It's not a final endpoint, but rather a transition point in a much larger cycle of existence.
Right.
Our actions in this life have consequences that go beyond our earthly lifespan.
Absolutely. The possibility of reincarnation raises the stakes, doesn't it? If our choices have the power to shape not only this life, but also our future lives, it makes you think carefully about the kind of life you're leading.
It definitely changes how we think about moral responsibility. You're not just accountable to yourself or society, but to your future selves as well. Does Socrates definitively claim that all of this is true? Or is he leaving room for doubt?
It's important to remember that Socrates frames these ideas as a myth, a way of exploring possibilities, not presenting absolute truth. He acknowledges that he doesn't have all the answers, that he's essentially building a raft to navigate these uncharted waters.
It's a good reminder that even someone as brilliant as Socrates can't claim certainty about what lies beyond this life. It makes his humility all the more remarkable, especially given his impending death.
His approach is honest. He's not claiming to have a direct line to divine knowledge, but is engaging in a process of reasoned inquiry, acknowledging the limits of human understanding.
It makes me think about how we approach big questions in our own lives. Even if we don't have all the answers, we can still engage in thoughtful exploration, weigh the evidence, and arrive at the most plausible explanation.
Exactly, and that's what makes the Phaedo so relevant even today. It's not just about the specific arguments for immortality, but about the way Socrates approaches these questions with intellectual rigor, openness to different perspectives, and a willingness to embrace uncertainty.
Socrates' demeanor throughout this dialogue is fascinating. Even though he's facing death, he remains calm, composed, almost cheerful at times. Is Plato using this portrayal of Socrates to make a point?
It's definitely a striking contrast to how we might expect someone in his situation to behave. I think Plato is highlighting the power of philosophy to provide solace and even joy, even in the face of death.
It makes you wonder if Socrates' composure is meant to be persuasive in itself.
Mm.
Is Plato suggesting that the way Socrates faces death lends credence to his arguments for immortality?
It's an interesting thought. By portraying Socrates as fearless and intellectually engaged in his final moments, Plato might be subtly reinforcing the idea that death is not something to be feared, perhaps even hinting that it's a transition to something greater.
So it's not just what Socrates says, but how he lives and dies that supports his philosophical claims. His actions become a kind of living testament to the power of his ideas.
Exactly. It's a powerful reminder that true philosophy isn't just about theoretical concepts, but about living in accordance with those principles, even in the most challenging of circumstances. I think it's also worth noting that while the Phaedo presents compelling arguments, some of the specific ideas might feel a bit outdated to us modern readers.
Like the analogy of the soul as a harmony. While it's a beautiful image, it doesn't necessarily align with our current scientific understanding of consciousness.
Right. Our understanding of the brain and how it functions has evolved significantly since Socrates' time. However, I think what's important is that the core message of the Phaedo still resonates. It's about the importance of seeking virtue and wisdom in this life and approaching death with courage and a sense of possibility.
It's not about clinging to specific details of the afterlife, but about recognizing the inherent worth of the soul and embracing the idea that our existence might extend beyond our physical lifespan.
It's a call to live a life worthy of an immortal soul, to cultivate those qualities that will endure beyond our earthly journey. It's a powerful message that transcends time and specific cultural contexts. Socrates' arguments about the soul's divine nature and his rebuttals of Simmias and Cebes, while framed within the context of his time, still offer valuable insights into the nature of consciousness and the possibilities that lie beyond death.
And while the myth of the afterlife he describes might not be taken literally, it still serves as a potent metaphor for the soul's journey, the challenges it faces, and the potential for purification and ascent to a higher state of being.
It encourages us to reflect on the deeper meaning of our existence and consider what awaits us beyond the confines of this earthly realm. The imagery of the rivers of the underworld, for example, prompts us to contemplate the obstacles and trials we might face in our own journeys of self-discovery and spiritual growth.
This brings us to a profound question that resonates even today. If the soul is truly immortal, as Socrates argues, what responsibilities does that place on us in this life? It's a big question. But it's an empowering one, too. If our souls carry on, doesn't that mean our actions kind of ripple outward, shaping our own destinies, maybe even influencing future lives or the whole spiritual landscape?
That's a really profound thought. It's something you see in a lot of spiritual traditions, too. The idea that we're all connected, that our choices make up a larger pattern of existence. The Phaedo asks us to consider the eternal impact of what we do and to live a life that honors the worth of our souls and their potential for immortality.
It's like we need to step up, recognize how important our choices are, and really try to live a life of virtue and purpose. But what if we mess up in this life? Are we doomed in the next? Are we stuck with our past mistakes forever?
Socrates doesn't get into specifics about karma or divine punishment, but he does suggest that the afterlife is a place where souls can become pure, a place to work through imperfections and try to understand more. Even if we make mistakes, even if we don't live up to our ideals, there's still a chance for us to grow and change.
Like a cosmic reset button. We can learn from our mistakes and try to make things right in future lives. We can keep evolving and improving our souls.
Exactly. And it all comes back to self-reflection and seeking wisdom. When we look at our lives, understand our motivations, and really try to be good, we're getting our souls ready for whatever comes next.
The Phaedo has me thinking about my own life, about my values, and the choices I make every day. Am I living in a way that will purify my soul and help it reach that higher realm Socrates described? Or am I holding on to things that will just weigh me down?
Those are exactly the kinds of questions the Phaedo wants us to ask. It's not about getting hung up on every detail of the afterlife. It's about being aware of how our actions can have eternal consequences. We're not just physical beings. We're souls on a journey. And that journey might go way beyond what we experience here on Earth.
It's a call to live with purpose, to recognize that everything is connected, and to always strive for excellence in everything we do, knowing that our choices could affect our souls forever.
It's a powerful message, one that has resonated with people for centuries.
It really goes beyond time and cultures. It speaks to our deepest desires for meaning, for purpose, and for something bigger than ourselves.
The Phaedo invites us to think about the biggest questions in life, to contemplate the mysteries of existence, and to be open to the possibility of transformation and growth, both in this life and beyond.
Well, this brings us to the end of our deep dive into Plato's Phaedo. We've gone through Socrates' arguments for the soul's immortality. We've looked at the arguments against it, and we've thought about how these ideas relate to our own lives. I don't know about you, but I'm feeling a sense of awe and a deeper understanding of the power of philosophy.
Me too, and a stronger sense of responsibility for taking care of our immortal souls.
We hope you found this deep dive as thought-provoking as we did. And remember, the conversation doesn't stop here. Keep thinking about these ideas. Talk about them and see how they might change your own understanding of life and death and the mystery of the soul. We'd love to hear what you think.
Keep asking questions, keep exploring, and keep searching for wisdom. Until next time, fellow deep divers.